Okay, I thought we might start with a test on what you remember from the last 10 sermons. So if you could pass the papers out now. That's not a very good start. So first of all, I would like to, before I get going with my main message, I would like to actually give... point out a couple of anniversaries that we have going on, which are really happening this past couple of weeks. And the first of those, I will be then getting into the message later on, talking about wisdom and knowledge, but also the limits of science, and finally, the challenge that Christ presents to us. But today... it's just one day after Remembrance Day, so I would like to remember the people who've fought to defend this nation and other nations given their lives to protect us. I was looking up, in fact, just yesterday was the 100th anniversary the end of the Battle of, 2 days ago, the end of the Battle of Passchendaele. Around 750,000 people died in 3 months in one battle. And this was so tragic that the British Prime Minister at the time wrote in his personal diary, which wasn't published till later, "No soldier of any intelligence now defends this senseless campaign." So many fought and defended. Sometimes it was very tragic. And this poem was written during World War I by John McCrae, a Canadian. And he actually died just 2 months after Passchendaele, also in the war. He said, "If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep though poppies grow in Flanders fields," where those battles took place. So I wondered if we could just have a moment of silence, just for a moment to pray and remember those who fought for us and defended us. Lord, thank you for those who've given their lives in defending us. Please be with them and their families. Amen. We also have another anniversary going on. It's actually a little bit past, but it's relevant to the topic that I'm talking on. So I wanted to mention it because just over 500 years ago was when Martin Luther King essentially started the Reformation. And there he is nailing the, I forget how many things to the door. 95? Okay. And it relates to the topic that I'm going to be talking about because it was a time really where people stood up and said, we're not just going to have a blind faith. We believe that God wanted us to read his word and study and understand and think. And I have a Bible here, which is a Geneva Bible from 1597, which is actually before the King James Version came out. And this is the Bible that any good Protestant who could read in, not 1517, but in 1597, this Bible had spread through Europe, and many ordinary Protestants were reading the Word of God for themselves and making up their own mind, admittedly with the guidance of the church. But we no longer just had to accept the word we could use, the word of the priest or the pope, but we could think for ourselves. And so I think that's important because I'm going to be talking about science and faith in a moment, which sort of relates to that. So, before I get into it completely, I want to point out One of the problems I have when I talk to people and people find I'm a chemistry professor is they say, oh, you know, my car's got a problem with the engine. What's wrong with it? Or, you know, what's that planet that's going around? You know, I'm supposed to know everything about all of science somehow, and I don't. I know a lot about organic chemistry, but even when it comes to other areas of chemistry, I'm pretty ignorant. Scientists are often quite specialized. So I have some general knowledge, of course, but I can't claim to be an expert on evolution or an expert on astronomy or Big Bang theory. So please accept that I only have limited knowledge. I'm also a Christian, but that doesn't make me an expert in theology either. And you'll have to, I defer to people like John when it gets to details of theology, and certainly not philosophy. I could never understand many philosophy books beyond the first chapter. So all I can do then is really present a personal statement of how I, as a scientist, also have a faith as well, and how those two are not only reconciled, but in my mind, they're two sides of the same thing, for me personally. Now, I apologize to those college students who have heard me talk on this before, because this isn't by any means the first time I've given this general message, but let's see. My story is I came from a mainly atheist family, or at least agnostic. I was baptized, but I think my baptism was the last time my mother set foot in church. So I like to joke that I rebelled by going to church, you know, and I was drawn to Christians. And when I learned about Christ in detail, obviously I'd heard growing up about Jesus, but when I was confronted with his message, I felt I had to respond some way. And I felt there's more than just me, and there's more than just humans. There's something outside of that, and Jesus seemed to provide the answer to that. And that's when I became a Christian at age 11. At the exact same time was when I saw the wonders of nature, and I was in tears when the college students were singing God of Wonders, because it's so much in line with what I believe. This is what drew me into chemistry, seeing the order in the periodic table, which, by the way, I'm wearing today, fascinated me, and it seemed to get at really what everything is made of was chemistry, and that's why I became a chemist. And at age 12, I started a club at my school, which allowed me to, and my friends, to do a lot of chemistry experiments. So I've been a scientist and a Christian since about that time. And it's no coincidence that these two things happened at the same time, because it was an awe of nature that brought me to that, those two decisions in my life. And I've never personally seen any conflict. Now, I realize some people will see conflicts and find difficulties in these things, but for me personally, I've never seen a problem with astronomy and Big Bang theory and where the universe came from. I've never seen any conflict with my belief in God. I follow a view of evolution that's called theistic evolution, which is God at work through evolution. That, for me personally, has never been an issue. So I realize in a church as big as this, there'll be diverse opinions on these things, but that works for me. And I've always seen I've always had a wonder of God at work in nature through all these things, chemistry as well. So I'm not the first to have this kind of view by any means. And Solomon was someone who of course, is famous for his proverbs, many about wisdom. So God told him by seeking after wisdom rather than riches or fame was very good. And that's why there are the wisdom books of the Bible. So blessed are those who find wisdom, those who gain understanding, for she is more profitable than silver and yields better returns than gold. And it's tempting, I suspect theologians are probably very tempted to think that this means spiritual wisdom. But there are many cases where Solomon talked about wisdom and understanding of nature. By wisdom, the Lord laid the earth's foundations. By understanding, he set the heavens in place. By his knowledge, the watery depths were divided, and the clouds let drop the dew. So we have nature and creation, but they're also a reflection of God's wisdom and his knowledge, his understanding, and his glory. We see these reflected in nature. So it's no wonder that I was drawn to chemistry. It's an example of God's wonder, or the things that God has done. Now, I'd like to read a passage which is not from the Bible. It's from the Apocrypha. Now, I don't know what people know about the Apocrypha. It's actually in this Bible. It is included, the set of books, which Catholics actually do put with their Bible, but Protestants traditionally don't, except apparently in 1597. But the Apocrypha is not part of the canon of the Bible, but it is. It was regarded when the canon was decided. These are books that Christians can learn from. So let's not ignore these books. And one of them is at least supposedly written by Solomon. And this is a passage I love because this is Solomon talking about the wisdom that God had given him, and I'd like to read it to you. May God grant me to speak with judgment and to have thoughts worthy of what I have received, for he is the guide even of wisdom and the corrector of the wise. For both we and our words are in his hand, as are all understanding and skill in crafts. For it is he who gave me unerring knowledge of what exists, to know the structure of the world and the activity of the elements, the beginning and end and middle of times, the alternations of the solstices and the changes of the seasons, the cycles of the year and the constellations of the stars, the natures of animals and the tempers of wild animals, the powers of spirits and the thoughts of human beings, the varieties of plants, and the virtues of roots. I learned both what is secret and what is manifest, for wisdom, the fashioner of all things, taught me. Now, for a scientist, I think this reads almost like a list of science subjects. We have here the varieties of plants and virtues of roots. We have medicine. We have the powers of spirits and thoughts of human beings. There is psychology. The natures of animals and the tempers of wild animals. We have biology. The cycles of the year and the constellations of the stars. We have astronomy. The alternations of the solstices and changes of the seasons, also to do with astronomy. The structure of the world and the activities of the elements. That's the bit I like the best, actually. I'm going to highlight that. There aren't many passages about chemistry from ancient times that we can read. And so I'll take what I can get. It may not be in the Bible, but... and also even the arts here and crafts. And I think also the structure of the world relates to physics. So God is the God of science. God is the God of nature. All of creation is his. And we shouldn't separate science from God as somehow being in conflict with each other. He created all of these things. And he blessed them all. And Solomon's words here, I think, reflect that. So, is this battery dying? No, it is. And there's a famous Christian philosopher, Francis Schaeffer, who says we shouldn't be afraid to confront these difficult questions. And I like this, where he says, the ancients were afraid that if they went to the end of the earth, they would fall off and be consumed by dragons. But once we understand that Christianity is true to what is there, true to the ultimate environment, the infinite personal God who's really there, then our minds are freed. We can pursue any question and can be sure that we will not fall off the end of the earth. So let's not be afraid to use our minds that God has given us. And hopefully I do that in my teaching. So, okay. I'd like to actually bring up my atheist friend here, Dr. Schugelmeier, who we need to make sure this microphone is on. Ooh, it is on, I think. All right, there you go, Dr. Schugelmeier.
Thank you.
So, because one of the reasons Christians have a problem with science often is because we hear a lot of scientific arguments by guys like Christopher Hitchens, who try and disprove God using science and logic. So, Dr. Schugelmeier.
Religious people all believe different things. Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Zoroaster, you can all be right. I said that wrong, but whatever.
They can't all be right. Okay. So, are we just weak-minded fools? Lots of God stories in the world. Thank you, Dr. Schugelmeier, for presenting that. So, most religions believe they have the truth. We can't all be right. And they jump from this to, if they can't all be right, they must all be wrong. Quod erat demonstrandum, apparently. But aren't all of us looking for God and we will find God in the culture that we live in? And we're all seeking after God. I'm not saying all of these religions are correct. I'm not a Zoroastrian. Is that how you pronounce it? But we all have something inside us that says there's something more than just me. And that's what all of us have been seeking. And I'll come to it later as to why I think Christ is the answer to this. But again, Dr. Schugelmeier.
Christian, why don't you prove God to me?
Well, I'm not sure I can, because I can't really prove God. God is something I know through faith. God is someone I know through faith.
Well, if you can't prove God, he obviously doesn't exist.
Well, we'll see about that. So, thank you, Dr. Schugelmeier. So some scientists, like Richard Dawkins here, argue, okay, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade. By the way, I put the Bible passages are in red, but anything an atheist says is in purple. I hope that's appropriate. The great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. Now, I do understand where Dawkins is coming from with this, and I'll get to that in a moment when I try and refute his argument. But it's also a cop-out to say, well, since we can't understand God, therefore we're just going to pretend he doesn't exist. Isn't that a cop-out as well? My mother used to throw all sorts of arguments at me like, oh, you can't believe all this nonsense because it doesn't make sense. And clearly, many people will say, we can't understand this with science. And since science defines everything, therefore, science faith can't be proven, it must be false. Quod erat demonstrandum. But does science really define everything? I don't think it does. I've never thought that science really defines everything. I get a joy from hearing music, when I look at a wonderful landscape, when I see my wife and family, all sorts of things, and these are more than just chemicals in the body, surely. Do they have no meaning whatsoever? That's the view of scientism, which is sort of this belief that science defines everything. And there's nothing else beyond the chemicals, beyond the forces acting through space and time. I'd like to challenge that and say, faith, well, this is what science covers, is it just deals with the observable world. And an essential component of science to make it useful, really, is it should be able to make predictions and be testable by experiment. That requires it to work in the physical world and have physical manifestations, physical consequences. Faith deals with that. Faith affects our material life, but also deals with the non-observable. And you can't prove things that, by definition, are to do with faith. Now, many scientists, when I gave this talk back in April, I think, to InterVarsity, my colleague from chemistry, Patty French, also spoke with me. And when she presented her testimony of faith as a scientist and as a Christian, one of the things she cited a lot was the many Christians from Newton, Boyle, and right through history, the many very important scientists who've had a very deep faith. And Einstein, I love this quote, science without religion is lame, religion without science is blind. And he's really saying we need both aspects. We need to use our minds to study nature, but if we think that science is all there is, then it's lame. It only deals with the physical world. Now, I'd like to, for a moment, give you a story that is very important to me personally, because it laid the seeds for me becoming a Christian. I said I became a Christian at the age of 11, but the seeds were already sown 2 or 3 years earlier when I learned in junior school about the local history of my area. And one of the stories was recorded by Bede, who is, you can see his grave in the local cathedral, in fact, in Durham. And Bede tells the story, in 627, Anglo-Saxon England, it was really just a set of kingdoms at the time, was mainly pagan. They followed the Anglo-Saxon gods that were mainly derived from the Norse gods. That's why we have Wednesday and Thursday are really Woden's Day and Thor's Day in our days of the week. We still use some of those Anglo-Saxon words today. And Edwin had married a Christian princess from Kent and had personally become a Christian. And he called together all his elders. The Saxons, even then, liked to have something like a parliament. There's a long history in England of kind of bringing together people for a parliament. And his chief priest obviously saw how things were going and decided quickly to side with Christianity. And he said he would profane his own altars. But they argued back and forth all evening. And then the winning argument came from one of his elders. And I'd like to read this if I can find where I printed it. The present life of man, O king, seems to me, in comparison of that time which is unknown to us, like to the swift flight of a sparrow through the room wherein you sit at supper in winter with your commanders and ministers and a good fire in the midst, whilst the storms of rain and snow prevail abroad. The sparrow, I say, is flying in at one door and immediately out at another. Whilst he is within, is safe from the wintry storm, but after a short space of fair weather, he immediately vanishes out of your sight into the dark winter from which he had emerged. So this life of man appears for a short space, but of what went before or what is to follow, we are utterly ignorant. If, therefore, this new doctrine contains something more certain, it seems justly to deserve to be followed. Now, Bede was writing this just maybe 60, 70 years after the events actually happened. And I can tell you, I've actually been to Bede's church. It was in the town where I lived. It's still there, built in 687 AD. This is history. It's not some mythology. This is how Christianity, this is how England became Christian. This argument was the argument that won the day with the elders of Northumbria. From Northumbria, Christianity quickly spread to all the other kingdoms, and by the time of King Alfred, all of England was Christian. And it's really based on this idea, forgive my crude graphics here, I thought I'd actually replaced it with a better one, but apparently I hadn't. This is the sparrow here flying through. Before birth is darkness, after death is darkness. The king is in the hall discussing things here. We know nothing of what came before and what comes after. And we can make this today the knowable and the unknowable. Science can deal with the knowable. Christ transcends that. He takes us from the unknowable and the knowable and back into the unknowable again. So we only see things as with a glass darkly, as it says in 1 Corinthians, I think. We only see things like in a mirror at the moment because there's much we don't know. Peter also had a sense of this, and this, when people began to desert Jesus, from this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. You do not want to leave too, do you? Jesus asked the 12. Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have come to believe and to know that you are the Holy One of God. So this is, in my mind, this passage has always meant a lot to me as well, for the same reason as the sparrow story, that it's, where else can we turn? Now, this is where Richard Dawkins might turn to me and say, well, you're just choosing something randomly. Why not choose the flying spaghetti monster or something else that you just make up? But Jesus is not just a made-up figure. The flying spaghetti monster is. Jesus was a historical figure, and there is a tremendous amount of historical evidence for Jesus walking the earth. There's a tremendous amount of evidence for what Jesus said and did. And clearly, his impact on history was enormous. And his impact is still being felt today. And I don't just mean in wars and things. I mean in people's lives. And so this is where I come with my story. I have to face this challenge. if Jesus really is a representation of God, then that's an enormous challenge. This is someone who's come from that vast unknowable place and was born on earth at a real time in history and came to touch that part in the light that we live in, the physical world, while we're alive. And he challenges us and challenges us to accept him. And that's why at the age of 11, I could no longer ignore the person of Jesus. I had to accept that he is God, and that's why I started to follow him. So I would like to also say that this is where the council took place. Those early Anglo-Saxons also felt challenged by the person of Jesus and his character and felt they couldn't ignore the story of Jesus and who he was in history. If you yourself are ignoring or trying to run away from those challenges that Jesus makes, I would encourage you to talk to people here today and pray with them, because I don't think we can walk away. Faith is not a cop-out. It's facing up to the challenge that Jesus gives us.